Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and today I'm interviewing Ron Gross. Welcome, Ron.
It's great to be with you, Ken. Thank you.
This is an unusual call in that we are conducting this interview for a very broad audience. Normally, I am talking about business topics specifically related to internet marketing, but I think this will be of interest to anybody in any kind of a business. Also, interestingly enough, it should be interesting to anybody in the field of scholarship, research, in the field of art, in the field of education, and it will soon become clear why that's so. Ron Gross had a huge impact on my life, and I just want to give you the quick story of that. For people listening to this who don't know me, I'm probably best known as the person who put on the very first conference on the subject of internet marketing, specifically web marketing. That was back in 1994. And since then, I've been an educator in that field, teaching for-profit businesses and nonprofit businesses and individuals how to use the internet to communicate their messages. And people might wonder, well, Ken, how did you get involved in that? How did you have the courage to dive into such an unformed field so early, to assume a leadership position when everything was in such a state of flux? And if I had to figure out and explain how I developed that frame of mind that I was able to use in the early 1990s, I have to trace it back to Ron Gross, and specifically to a book that he wrote, which we're going to be talking about. We're also going to be talking about a number of his other books. But before we get into the actual details of this call, I'd like to highlight some of the themes that we're going to be covering. Number one, first and foremost, we're going to be talking about the awesome power of learning how to learn. In my opinion, there's probably no more important skill that we could develop than that one ability. Two, we're also going to talk about the power of the written word and the book, both reading them and writing and publishing them. And another theme that we're going to be covering is the idea of excellence. What is it, and how to achieve it, and is it realistic for all of us to achieve excellence in some area of our lives? So, Ron, we've laid out a huge agenda for this call, but I think you're uniquely capable of helping us cover all these topics. So are you up for it?
Yeah, Ken, it's a pleasure and a privilege to do this with you. I would just say that that it's going to be very easy in a way, because unlike most audiences that I speak to, you and the people who are listening to this tape, particularly those who have studied with you, really exemplify everything that I've championed about learning how to learn and the importance of the written word and excellence. And so I don't have to do some of the usual stuff I have to do in trying to make this stuff realistic and lifelike for the audience, because so many of the people who are listening to this tape really exemplify and I think will recognize themselves in what we're going to be talking about. And that's, regrettably in a way, that's often the case, that the people who make the most use of these principles are the people who naturally come to them and who are already doing a whole lot of it. So if the people who are listening to us do recognize themselves, I would ask them to listen for how they can go even further with these impulses which they've had within themselves and these accomplishments which they've achieved, because they're the ones who can probably benefit the most.
Absolutely, and actually, and we'll get to that in a bit, but that was one of the impacts of your book. It crystallized some feelings and notions and attitudes that I had, but until you just came out and said, hey, you can do this, and here's how, I wasn't really able to put the full force of all my energies behind it. Talking about championing things, I think probably everybody on this call has at one point or another heard the term lifelong learning. Well, you know, terms like that just don't fall out of the sky. They usually come from some source. And in this case, we are talking to the source of that phrase. I believe, Ron, you actually even wrote a book or a series of essays on lifelong learning.
Yes, well, my first book, or one of my first books, but the first one that had really widespread impact, was called The Lifelong Learner, mm-hmm. and then was followed by a paperback called Handbook for the Lifelong Learner. And in that book, I did pose the model for self-directed personal learning that is focused by you on goals that are important to you, and that is conducted by you with a lot of help from what I call the Invisible University, but
mm-hmm.
basically directed by you, where you are, as it were, the CEO of your own education, and your education is directed at achieving the goals that are most important for you. And this is very different from what the prevailing attitude was back then, and I think still is, about what education is. I had an entirely different conception of what getting an education meant.
Sure, and for, I think maybe for some people, they may think, well, sure, of course you self-direct your own education. Isn't that obvious? But I think for the average person and in our society at large, and certainly I know in my own case, the way I grew up was you went to grammar school, and they told you what to learn, and then you went to high school, and they told you what to learn, and then you went to college, and they told you what to learn. Then maybe you went to a professional school of some kind, and they told you what to learn, and then you took that piece of paper out into the marketplace, and somebody told you where to sit, and told you what to do, and that's pretty much how you lived your life. And you know, I think everybody has this sense that, or many people have this sense that you need to be credentialized in order to go out and do something in the world. So, in other words, if you want to pursue, a field A, you've got to go to a formal program that trains people in field A. You have to pass all kinds of certifications. Now, of course, if you want to be an accountant or an attorney or a medical doctor, yeah, there are very clear and somewhat rigid systems for you to follow. But in most of the fields of activity on Earth, you really don't need to wait around for someone to formally certify you. Now, in the book that I picked up, and I'll never forget, it was in the old Barnes, well, not the old Barnes & Nobles, but the big Barnes & Nobles on Fifth Avenue, when that was the biggest bookstore in the world, which talk about how the world has changed. There are now bigger bookstores in remote suburbs of outer America. But that used to be the biggest bookstore, and I remember walking in there and seeing this unusual book called The Independent Scholar's Handbook. And I didn't really intend to be a scholar. I didn't have any interest in being a scholar, but something about The Independent Scholar's Handbook just caught my eye, and I picked it up and I started flipping through it, and I realized that this wasn't strictly a book about becoming a scholar or even an independent scholar. It was really a book about self-directed learning and how far it could take you. So, Ron, you are the person who coined the phrase lifelong learner, and you're certainly the person that coined the phrase the independent scholar, and both those phrases helped give direction to pretty significant movements in the field of education. What I want to talk about in the Independent Scholar's Handbook, and perhaps you could help illustrate some of these points, you just listed seemed to me, dozens of people who made not little contributions to human learning, but, you know, massive sea change, you know, world-changing views to the worldview in various disciplines, science, literature, history. And these innovations came from people who weren't even considered professionals in the field. Can we talk about some of those case studies?
Sure can. As we all know, Darwin, Einstein, Freud, the founders of our modern culture, are not known as professors, did not live their lives following that profession or within academe. We don't think of them as being associated with any university. I'm sure they lectured at lots of universities, but and Einstein, of course, went to the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, but that's really a separate quite outside the departmental structure of academe, and we certainly don't think of him as Professor Einstein.
Sure.
We just think of him as Einstein. But even below that supreme level, though that supreme level is important because it does illustrate what you're proposing, that the highest levels of achievement in the sciences, the arts, the humanities, the social sciences are achievable by without following the academic route.
What's so amazing, if I could just jump in, you know, academia is a fairly rigid structure. And yet when you look at the people that actually have the biggest influence on academia, it's guys that were outside the system, right?
Absolutely. Certainly, because quite frankly, within the system, the people are so fixated, necessarily because it's their reward and punishment system, they're so fixated on climbing the slippery pole of publishing more and more about less and less, accumulating publishing credits by what's called the salami method, meaning slicing any finding of yours into the smallest possible slices and then publishing them in the most possible places, even though it makes for thousands and thousands of articles of virtually no significance. And everyone in academia admits this. This is not me posing this against academia. It's a plaint of academics themselves in when they come together every year. So the fact is that the dangers of being in academia are quite extraordinary for distracting you from things that really matter, and particularly things that really matter to you. Everybody is organized into what we've come to call in business silos, the departmental disciplines, biology, history, economics, etc., and the sub-disciplines and the schools within those disciplines. So the fact is that real intellectual enterprise, going after any of the big questions, is virtually forbidden to academics unless they want to put their career on the line. And for that reason, many, many breakthroughs, and as you say, I catalog hundreds in the book, are made by people outside. And particularly, and here's where I think that some of the people who are listening to us would find this interesting, that I'm particularly interested in how many experts find their expertise in their work, that is, taking the work that they're doing, the field that they've chosen to try to achieve in as a professional and as a business person, and develop a deeper and wider understanding of it, and then produce a work of intellectual value, even as they're using their knowledge to advance in their field. And I'm thinking of one example, for instance, is a man named Sam Florman, who's a partner in a construction contracting company in the Northeast. He got interested in addressing general readers from the point of view of his occupation or profession. That is, began asking himself, well, what kind of contribution does engineering, which is was his field, what contribution does engineering make to our common happiness, our prosperity, our social structure? And he ended up writing a series of essays which became a book called The Existential Pleasures of Engineering, which was a dazzling book that really exemplified the fact that the doers in our society, the people like those who are listening to us, really have a lot of important things to say to everyone else, but they really rarely take the time or cultivate the skills to say it. So I would say that, and that's where the scholarly and research and educational interests that you mentioned at the start come in, that any practically anybody, and just to illustrate how anybody it can be, there's a wonderful book called On High Steel, The Education of an Iron Worker by Mike Cherry. Mm-hmm. Mike Cherry is an iron worker, works on the skyscrapers that are put up in New York and other cities. And reflecting on his experiences, he wrote a whole book on what it means to be an iron worker and how that occupation contributes to our society. And it's an absolutely wonderful book which got wide recognition. I guess the most famous champion of this kind of work is Eric Hoffer,
mm-hmm.
Who worked his whole life as a longshoreman on the California docks,
mm-hmm.
Never got any kind of academic certification, and yet became world-renowned for his thinking, for what he could come up with sitting with a pad on a bench in Golden Gate Park on his days off and just trying to think hard about issues that he thought were important to people in our society. So I think here you have a longshoreman, an engineer, and an iron worker, pretty much covering the continuum of occupational levels, but in each case finding meaning and significance in their work and producing works of intellectual importance.
And the Eric Hoffer book, True Believer, is actually a book that's read by a lot of marketers because there's so much insight into how people think, how they come to form beliefs. It's extremely useful to marketers as well, so I just wanted to mention that.
Great.
So far we've been talking about using, and in each case, each one of these individuals, there was no school for steelworkers to learn how to write self-reflectively about their place in the world and their contribution in the world. There was no path for that individual, or Eric Hoffer, or the other gentleman you mentioned, but yet they found a path. Now, we're talking right now specifically about the products being books, but this finding of a self-education path can apply to any field you're in. You may be an artist, you may be a business owner, you may be an entrepreneur, you may be an educator, you may be any one of a countless number of occupations. And I think at least one of the critical differentiating factors that helps people, let's say, break out of the box and really create something of personal importance and also importance to, you know, the larger world, is this ability to find a path of self-education. Now, you laid that path out very clearly in the Independent Scholar's Handbook, and again, the emphasis on that book was for people that wanted to create works of scholarship. But actually, I never became a scholar, and I never used any of the things that you talked about to establish scholarly credentials, but I did use them to jump into fields, you know, new fields, and establish myself as an expert in various fields. When you and I met, I had a business called Optimal Learning, which was based on teaching people how they could learn some of the mechanical things related to learning, how to read faster, how to remember better, and so on. And that was a field that really was wide open, and it was open to anybody that was willing to be creative and think outside the box. So let's talk about the tools and the pathways and the methods that a person can use to achieve excellence in their own personal knowledge, and then in helping get that knowledge out to the world.
Sure, Ken. Well, let me just start with an example which will be very familiar from your own field, from the field of the internet and computer programming. It's something I see virtually every week, and I'm sure that many of the people who are listening to this have seen this. I do a good deal of my consulting work is for companies in what's called Silicon Alley, which is the Manhattan version of Silicon Valley, internet companies and computer programming companies. And when I walk the halls there on a consulting assignment, what I see all the time is something that I'm sure you and lots of people have seen, which is on the doors of the little cubicles and offices of the internet engineers, systems architects, programmers, you'll find that very often they have put the certificates that they have obtained on the door with obscenities written on them.
Really?
Yeah, to express their. I don't know. Maybe this is a New York thing. I frankly don't do that much work with Silicon Valley firms. I specialize in the ones that are nearer at hand in New York.
Sure.
But clearly, they want to express their disdain for the need to enroll in a course to learn this stuff, because of course they're learning it by the methods that we're about to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Things like the Hey Joe School, you know.
Yep.
Hey Joe, can you teach me how to do this? But at a fairly high level. But we've all used that for, you know, Hey Joe, can you show me how to mark a passage when we were first learning to do word processing.
This is such an important point, especially for my audience, because we are in a field where there are no books, there are no courses, there are no institutes, there is no certification. We are literally on the cutting or bleeding, depending on how you look at it, edge of something that's never existed before. And so we can't even get a certificate to put on our wall to write an identity on, you know. It had never occurred to me that I'd never thought about it until you just mentioned this. Not only are these skills that we're going to talk about useful and cool and kind of neat to have in this field of internet marketing, they're essential. I'll just flat out say it. In this day, right now, maybe 20 years from now things will be different, but right now, today, you can't be in internet marketing unless you are a supercharged, self-directed learner. You just can't be in the field. Or if you try to be in the field, you'll always be 1, 2, 3, 18 steps behind.
Mm-hmm.
So this, I knew this was an important call today, but this just crystallized it for me. So let's talk about how you go from being a guy or a gal, just sort of, you know, having a vague notion that you want to get better in some field, to somebody who has accumulated really significant mastery, and not only that, has been recognized for that mastery, because, you know, that's an important piece of it too.
Sure. Well, I would say you start, number one, with yourself. You start by becoming aware of yourself as a learner. And by that I mean you start to note how much and how fast you've learned on your own and are learning on your own. You take some, you know, some self-evaluation instruments that are easy enough to find on the internet to learn what kind of learner you are. How do you prefer to learn? How does your brain work best? There's a lot of very available and accessible guidance on this. Simple stuff. Some of it's very simple, and you're probably aware of it already. Are you more alert and ready to learn in the morning or in the evening? Are you a lark or an owl? Simple stuff about biorhythms. What kind of place, what kind of environment, what kind of sensory input do you find nurtures your learning?
Mm-hmm.
Do you like to have the radio on? Do you like to have it hot and cold? And then moving from that, becoming aware of how you learn, and then, of course, psychological stuff, like do you prefer to learn from the top down or the bottom up? Do you like, if you're going into a new field, if you think back to when you entered a new field, maybe a new hobby or a new interest, quite outside the business realm, though a business one is just as good, did you prefer to go around gathering a lot of foraging for a lot of facts and points of view and data and bits and pieces to stimulate your mind, or did you want to go for the overall big picture? Did you want to get a blueprint of the entire field first and then choose where to hone in on what you wanted to learn about in detail? So the first thing is to start with yourself. Our brains are different. If our face is reflected on the outside, how differently our brains function on the inside. Mm. Some of us would have noses that were as long as an elephant's trunk. and we have to realize that. And not realizing it makes people feel that all of us feel that we're kind of dumb about some things, and we tend to sometimes think that that's a reflection on our overall intelligence or ability. But the fact is that each of us is very strong, find some kind of learning real easy, real smooth, no problem, and even enjoyable, and other kinds of learning in other subjects and areas, industrial strength, pain.
Mm-hmm.
So realizing that that's true of everybody, and that everybody has their easy tasks and their hard ones in terms of learning and mastery and acquiring knowledge and understanding, and realizing that if we know what our strengths are, we can play from our strengths. One of the things I do with companies is a little game called Peak Performance Poker, which
mm-hmm.
is a Las Vegas casino style event in which everybody, we have decks of cards with these strengths, these personality strengths on them, and you form a hand that reflects your strengths.
Mm-hmm.
You form a five-card hand. Poker's so popular nowadays that we developed this game. You develop a hand that reflects your five of your top strengths. Then you share with the people at your little table how you use those five strengths to cope with a situation or seize an opportunity or solve a problem. And by the end of the workshop, you've seen how other people, you've kind of joined hands to see how other people and how everybody in the group has different strengths which lead to their success, and then how groups can work together to create a gang brain that is more powerful in every kind of task than any individual brain in the room alone. So that's the kind of knowledge and experience that you can have either on your own or in a group that can make you aware of the way your brain functions best and how you can play on your strengths, play from your strengths and play on your strengths for both your success and your happiness, because psychologists have learned that if you fail to play your strengths, that you're not only frustrated in achieving your goals, but you actually have reduced mental health. It's unhealthy not to use these talents that you have and these strengths that you have. Mm-hmm. So I say begin not with what you want to learn, but with yourself, with an enjoyable but hard look at your own way of thinking, way of learning, style of communicating, and begin to learn about that even more than you may know already.
What a great lesson, and in a sense to go follow the path of least resistance. In other words, sometimes in school we're given the impression that, hey, you're no good unless you master every single subject evenly,
mm-hmm.
And you're not allowed to ignore any subject.
Right.
And in reality, it's lovely to be well-rounded and so on, but if you look at professional achievement or achievement in any field, it's usually somebody that's not necessarily completely well-rounded. They've found their strength, and they've played to that strength, and they've let the things that they're just not good at go, or they partner with somebody else, or they employ somebody else to do that. So
exactly,
achievement is not a matter of being, it's, again, well, being well-rounded, it has a lot to recommend it, but it can be a terrible trap, and it's much better. I think you just stated it so clearly, to figure out what's natural for you and let it go in that direction. I mean, I still at this late time in the game, I still sometimes wish, oh, I wish I was better at, this aspect of internet marketing or that aspect of it.
Sure.
But then I wake up and say, hey, I'm really good at this particular angle on it, and then I just need to find the allies to help me with the other angles.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that we need to realize as adults, that ideal of the well-roundedness, as you just pointed out, is really obsolete, because where does that ideal come from, that you need to be well-rounded? It comes from two places, I think, really. One is that when we're children in school, there's a feeling that we should be exposed to all of these different realms of knowledge, and that's fine, mm-hmm. in order for us to discover. But the point is for us to discover the ones that are the one or the ones that are most congenial and most interesting and most productive for us. Well, we're past that stage now as adults, so we no longer have that justification for feeling that we need to be well-rounded. We were exposed as well as people could to all of those. We've made our choices, or we can make new ones. But at this point, focus is much more important than breadth. And the second place it comes from, of course, is the politics of the educational system, because mm-hmm. in the educational system, and particularly at the college level, you've got all these people in different disciplines who all want a piece of the student. The mathematics department says all students in this university must have 6 hours of mathematics because we want to keep our jobs.
Right, it's a marketing ploy.
Yeah, we don't want to just teach the people who are going to become mathematicians. You're not going to be able to pay us our big salaries for that.
Right.
So in both cases, we're now free of that as adults. And the more general point about that is that virtually everything that we interjected about education and learning is susceptible to a similar critique, namely, if it ever had any validity, it had validity when we were youngsters, children, young people, even graduate students, but it has virtually no validity now. Yet we've carried it over. As you said, we spent so many years being in a system in which someone else decided what you would learn, when you would learn it, at what pace you would learn it, from what resources you would learn it, why you would learn it, how you would prove that you learned it, all of that stuff is really obsolete for us now. We need to take charge of all of those functions, which actually is a bit of work, which we are not accustomed to, and that is a failure of the school and college system, I think. That is, if you look at the aims of the declared mission statement of any school or college in the country, you're going to find that it includes, we want our students after graduation to be lifelong learners.
Mm-hmm.
But if you then ask, well, now exactly where and when in the course of their passing through your institution do they learn that? Mm-hmm. Where exactly do you help them to develop the skills and capabilities and confidence and experience in being lifelong learners? Of course, it's nowhere, because
right.
they're always either taking biology and learning biology or history and learning history, right? There is no place at which the institution is actually even attempting, can even point to the fact that it's attempting, let alone succeeding, in instilling what it claims to be one of its chief goals, if not its chief goal.
Well, institutions are not very good at formally training their members to be independent of the institution.
Exactly.
It's almost counter to what their survival. So we start with a very important point then, which is realize that you're unique. I mean, again,
mm-hmm.
this may sound like, hey, I've heard that before, but let's look at it in the context of learning, lifelong learning, and achieving excellence. Understand that you're unique. You have strengths and weaknesses. You have particular ways of learning, and take the time to figure all that out. I would say take the path of least resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to master things that are impossible for you. Instead, become great at the things where you've got a natural gift. And I think you cover quite a bit of this in a book that you wrote called, I believe it was Peak Performance Learning.
Peak Learning.
Right. Peak Learning. Let's go to the next stage. So let's say I figured out, hey, I'm good at this. I like this. This is how I like to learn it. What's next?
Next is thinking of your learning in terms of learning projects.
Mm-hmm.
Your learning isn't the unit of your learning isn't the course or the even the workshop or the seminar or the conference that you go to, though all of those can be good inputs, good resources. But before you get to that, you want to develop the skill of sketching out a little learning project plan. That is, you want to sit back and decide what exactly do I want to learn, understand, know about, become, be able to do. And you want to check whether it truly advances your purpose and whether it's cost effective. And then once you've developed, and of course, you know, in the books I give, I have matrices for doing these plans. Then once you've done that, so you've got your plan that over this period of time, I want to master this, this, and this to this level. Here's why it's worth it to me. Here's the kind of resources I'm willing to and able to put into it in terms of time and financial resources. Then you begin to look around for how you can meet these goals.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, you consider several alternative courses that are being offered, or seminars or workshops, or hiring a consultant for a kind of high-level Hey Joe, hiring a consultant or a coach. That's where people probably come to, you know, to your work, Ken,
mm-hmm.
so profitably. And that's why, as I say, it said at the start, you exemplify what I'm talking about, and the people who enroll in your offerings are exemplifying it, because they obviously have looked around and have decided that this looks like the best way for me to learn what I want to learn in this field,
mm-hmm.
Rather than just accepting what some institution has decided.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you use resources like that. And let me give you two very homey examples.
Okay.
To make it very concrete what this process entails and why it is a little bit of work but well worth it. Many people will, you know, come to me and say, I found this seminar, do you think I should take it? And my answer always is, well, let's look at the other two possibilities. If you think a seminar is the way you like to learn, because it might be you learn better from a book or from a private consultant or from going to a conference, but if a seminar is your preferred way of learning this, then let's find three other seminars that are competitive with this and look at them and get the information that we need about exactly what's covered and what kind of results they've gotten and what students have said about them, and then let's decide. And my kind of golden rule, or iron rule, I'd say, I guess, about this is that you should always be willing to devote 15% of the time that you estimate that the entire learning project is going to take you. You should be willing to devote up to 15% of that time in your decision about what is the best investment of the other 85% of your time. That is, in this process of finding alternative ways of doing this and exploring them. So that's a discrete part of the process. And my contention, which I document, and I document the fact that it works in the books, of course, with case studies and findings, is that you will get so much more out of the 85% when you get down to the actual learning, because you will be in the right place with the right person, with the right resources, learning the right stuff, than if you just plump for the first thing that comes along and rely on them to be telling you what you most want to learn. So so that's my first rule, is the actual planning consists of allotting 5, 10, 15, sometimes it's a lot easier. For example, let's say you're at the library and you just have decided you want to look into a certain topic. Pull down 3 or 4 books, take a half an hour to examine them, and I actually provide, of course, systematic ways to do that, to x-ray a book through the index to find out what it's really, what it really covers rather than what the table of contents promises you. Take a half an hour to examine 3 or 4 alternative books that cover what you want to learn from a book, and then take the book out and invest the rest of the time in reading it, but also reading it strategically, of course, rather than just starting on page one. So basically, My step in terms of learning projects is to take on the responsibility and invest the time in planning your these little learning projects, whether it's the choice of a book or the choice of a seminar or the choice of whether to go to an expensive conference or not, or indeed the choice of enrolling in a doctoral program. Mm-hmm. Same thing applies to a doctoral program, only more so. It's going to be a much bigger a major professional program, like an MBA, say, if you're considering whether an MBA would add to your strength. Since that's going to be a much bigger investment of time and money, it means that you can and should spend much more time and money at the start on evaluating what you're getting yourself into. Because don't we all know so many people who've enrolled in elaborate programs or gone to expensive seminars or conferences and really not found when they came out the other end that they had gotten something of real value?
It happens all the time, and I didn't realize we were going to touch on this topic, because it's something that impacts my business all the time. I'm in a field where there are a lot of other things that people can do educationally. There's a lot of educational choices in the internet marketing world, for example, and
mm-hmm.
I see a lot of people, take a hair trigger approach to their decision making of where they're going to invest time and money. And sometimes we're talking about significant amounts of money,
sure,
with very little, if negligible, return. And it's painful for me to see, because I know the results that people that go to our trainings get
mm-hmm.
is very different. And I think you're raising a really important point here, is that you need to have a lot of self-knowledge first, and then you need to be a really hard-nosed consumer, I would say. I mean, this is another way of saying what you said,
mm-hmm.
About the various educational opportunities that are out there in whatever field.
Mm-hmm.
And that one characteristic, if people would develop that, could probably save them quite a bit of wasted time, money, and effort down the line. Very often, people will jump at the first thing that's presented in a compelling way,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to sitting back and saying, "Well, hey, look, there's lots of people in this field. Obviously, the advertiser is going to tell me that he or she's the best.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take a step back and see who else is in the field, and look at things like the person's track record, like their credentials, like the outcomes for people that have taken the trainings in the past. These are really important things to look into."
Exactly, Ken. And let me just pick up on that last one, because I consider it one of the great consumer scandals of our society. We mentioned the outcomes for people who've taken the training,
mm-hmm.
Or who've gone through the experience. Well, to me, the wastage that we all see around us, I think, which of us doesn't know, so many people who've actually gone to things like law school, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We all know people who went to law school and then came out and discovered what the real experience of being a lawyer today means. And within 2 or 3 years, they were out of that field.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, of course, the attrition figures for new entries into the field of lawyering bear out the fact that our experience isn't just personal, that it's a systemic issue. Well, to me, that's a tremendous failure and crime of the professional schools. If I were king of the educational system, I would decree that every professional school from medical school to legal education to bartender school, which, by the way, tends to be better in this regard than Harvard Law School.
Absolutely. You know what you're getting into when you become a bartender.
Exactly.
You can go and watch people do it.
Precisely. Yeah. Exactly. The mom-and-pop vocational school on the second floor with the big sign of, baritology, their record of performing what they promise is far better than most of the law schools in this country. Now, that's the fault of the schools because my decree would be that they could not admit someone to the full program until they'd spent 6 months in an apprentice or internship which showed them what the kind of work exposed them to the kind of environment, the kind of work that they would be doing by their seeing people who graduated 2 years ago and what they're doing in the cubicle next to them.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be such a saving in personal anguish. The cost to families and individuals of these expensive trainings, the social cost of going through all this malarkey to no good effect. So I consider this an absolute scandal, which is not because academia is so prestigious, no one ever investigates this as a consumer scandal. But if you were doing the same thing in any other field, it would be considered a scandal if there were this kind of betrayal of promises and a failure to alert the consumer about the actual risk. So to come back to your point, I think the most important thing you can look at, all of these things are important, of course, whether the offering is the right thing for you, whether it's covering what you want, whether it's taught in a way that you're going to find receptive, but above all is what happened to the last 5 years of graduates of this program or people who took this seminar. Where's the data? Let's see some data about that, and is this so that I can estimate my chances for success?
Excellent.
And sometimes it's not the fault of the program. The program may teach what it teaches very well, and one thinks here I'm sitting in New York City, so I think of the thousands and thousands of waiters and waitresses, wait persons, who are music students and acting students and painters who've taken what may be excellent artistic training, but there's just no market for what they have to offer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even the fault of the teachers in these institutions. It's the fault of the whole system of generating a system that recruits people with a dream that is so flawed that that the vast majority of them are doomed to failure and frustration.
And yet, with some minor adjustments, for instance, someone that studies acting, obviously their first dream would be employment in the field of acting.
Mm-hmm.
But the things they're learning in acting have applicability in all kinds of other human endeavors.
Of course,
that's something that could be added to the mix so that when people are trained. Dancers go through this too, of course. They spend 10, 15 years of their lives completely focused on this very intense discipline. And then, of course, you can't dance at that level forever.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much 30, 35, 40 is considered a very old dancer. Then what?
Mm-hmm.
And yet the things that a dancer learns are unbelievably applicable to all kinds of, the discipline, the regularity, the focus on fundamentals. I mean, these are things that could transition to all kinds of other fields. But that needs to be included in the education of actors and dancers and musicians.
Exactly,
and so
Ken.
On.
You bet. Well, listen, if they make me king, I'd like to make you my vice regent.
Okay, I'm ready for that job.
Great.
Any time. Let's go now to the next step. So step one, of course, know who the heck you are and what you like and what you're good at and how you like to learn. Number two, become a fairly hard-nosed consumer of the various opportunities that are out there. Don't just jump at the first thing.
Exactly.
Look, take a broad view before you commit. Okay, so now what?
The third one, to my mind, is awareness of what I call the invisible university. And by that I mean the enormous variety of diverse learning opportunities that now exist, which many people, most of us, don't think of unless we actually remind ourselves of them unless we have a checklist such as I provide to remind us of all of the different ways that we can learn. And I'll just mention a few that people sometimes miss out on. We tend to think that learning it has to be located in an educational institution, a school or college. But first of all, of course, to start with the most obvious, most people do not make anything like the full use of the public library. I'm constantly astounded. I met an entrepreneur a couple of years ago who was doing entrepreneurial development in the field of alternative energy, and he was trying to investigate this field by driving around to visiting all of the different libraries in our area here. But he was doing that by driving around in ever larger concentric circles, hitting libraries further and further out from where he lived to see if they had any additional resources that he could use.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know that you can with a phone call and a computer click that the libraries will put the books on a van and have them, you know, the regional library service will have any book from any collection they have in your hands within 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
At that point it was a phone call. Now it's a click on the computer. But people simply didn't. Now this is a man who was into alternative energy, and he was driving hundreds of miles in his automobile, polluting the environment and wasting his time, and of course missing a lot of resources, because instead of seeing all the resources on his screen, deployed for him plus ancillary resources at connecting libraries, he was just literally going and finding the books on the shelf and seeing what was there.
He could have learned this simply by starting a conversation with a librarian.
Well, of course, exactly. So this is an extreme case, which I'm sure none of your readers would be guilty of, but I could adduce more arcane but equally useful kinds of ways in which public library connects with university libraries and can provide you with virtually any resource that you want, almost worldwide, but certainly regionally and very likely nationally. So the first thing is to really have that conversation with your librarian. Go take one of the orientation courses, or find a librarians love to display what they've got. So that's kind of the most basic. Then, of course, most people are aware these days of all of the networks that are available, computer-based networks, web-based networks, for networking and discoursing with people in the field that you're interested in. So that's number two, really becoming knowledgeable about the networks in the field that you're interested in and getting involved so that you begin to hear about things that are of particular interest to you. Let's see, a third one I'd say would be looking at all of the learning institutions other than schools and colleges. That is adult programs, church-based programs, arts-based programs, volunteer organizations.
Industry-based programs.
Yeah, industry-based programs. Right, exactly. Apprenticeships, etc. Then I also want to be sure that our listeners know about the institutions that provide very legitimate and very, more important, very personalized credentials, where you can build your own graduate program. A graduate program, if a degree is going to be useful to you down the road, there are now a number of institutions that will enable you to create your own graduate program around your interests, so that as you're learning what you need to know for your own advancement and success in your business or profession, you're also earning an academic degree for it, which is well respected.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to be sure people know about that. Many people are still not aware that this kind of web-based external degree, as it's called, is available.
And that's all fairly new.
Well, it's been around for 20 or 30 years, I think, but still very many people are not aware of it or thinks there's something shoddy about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are shoddy operatives in the field, but it's pretty easy to sift your way to the legitimate stuff.
Okay. And so now we're we're getting more specific about finding the resources, all the resources.
Exactly.
Beyond the obvious. Mm-hmm. That's probably the key here is we all have a natural learning style. We all have a comfort zone. But sometimes the best resources are elsewhere. For instance, the guy who was more comfortable driving around in his car, if he had just gotten out of his comfort zone just a little bit and mm-hmm. struck up a conversation with a librarian, he would have been way better off. And, you know, we may laugh at that guy, but I have done similar, metaphorically, similar things, digging through tons and tons and tons of material where I might have been better off taking the time to identify one or two people and just getting them on the phone.
Me too. In fact, we just went through this in our family. We were trying to crack this nut about which of the insurance plans to cover prescriptions was the right one for us.
Mm-hmm.
And, we spent a day or two fumbling around before we found the right resource, the right source for obtaining good evaluations of these plans. And what we did then is actually a good lesson which was we did a kind of after action report it's the next phase of this process that I was going to get to is evaluation. We did an evaluation of, well, gee, where did we go wrong here? How could we have saved ourselves a lot of time and effort and frustration? What should we have done that would have led us more quickly to the best source rather than flailing around and finally finding it but having obviously expended a good deal of unnecessary and unproductive work on finding the information? And so we then from now on, hopefully, we'll be smart enough to make that part of our general learning savvy, learning methodology.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the important general lesson that, as you say, Ken, all of us will continue throughout our lives to learn not so well occasionally,
mm-hmm.
to find that we have wasted time, learned the wrong thing, learned it in the wrong way. The as in all cases of that kind of glitch, the way you redeem it is by figuring out exactly where you went wrong and installing a little mechanism in your brain or in your organization that assures that you're not going to make that mistake again. And that way we turn mistakes into improved performance down the line. And so we now will, the next time we're confronted with something like this, I think we'll be that much smarter as a result of having wasted some time this time. So that really gets us to the fourth phase, which is evaluating your own learning.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me has two aspects. One is developing whatever documentation is appropriate and necessary in your case to assure you and other people that you've learned what you think you've learned. We need it to some degree for ourselves so that we know that we're not kidding ourselves and thinking that we've learned something when we haven't, or that we've learned it enough where actually our learning is only partial and we have to keep going, or developing what we need to show others that we know it, if that's necessary, whether they're customers or partners or people in an organization that we're in. So there's that kind of evaluation, and there's also the kind of evaluation that asks, okay, how well did I do this learning, and how can I do it better next time by learning from any mistakes that I made or indeed any successes that I had? What did I do right? What did I do wrong? And how can I build that knowledge into my learning to how to learn savvy for next time?
This is such an incredibly profound point because your work is all about becoming conscious of the learning process, recognizing that learning goes on all the time in all kinds of different contexts, way beyond formal training situations or school situations. And now you're talking about not only developing a conscious program for self-education, but also a conscious program for evaluating your effectiveness as a self-educator, you know, sort of doing post-game analyses.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I'm going through one right now. I feel at the time of this recording that we're doing that we are in sort of the second major wave of the Internet and Internet marketing, the first one being in 1994, 1995. And I am now, not in a formal way, but in a focused way, I'm now evaluating what I did right from the point of view of a learner in those early years, and how I can take the lessons, and also what I did wrong, and mm-hmm. Equally as important, and how I can take those lessons to this current time, because it's a very similar time. It's a time of incredibly rapid change where there seems to be literally no single comprehensive source you can go to for an overview. It's a jigsaw puzzle at best. And how do you function? And it's fast-moving, fast-changing, and the stakes are incredibly high. How do you function in an environment like that? And I went through it once in 94, and I had been through it before in other fields. And I want to point out to everybody, guided largely by the inspiration of Ron's writing, and Ron and I actually got to know each other way back then as well, and so I had that extra added benefit too. But yeah, I'm doing a very intense sort of post-game analysis of the last time we went through a big sea change in Internet marketing. And I think, I'm going to guess, because it's something I've only done once or twice in my life, I'm going to guess this is something most people not only have never done, have never even thought about doing, and I'm further going to guess that if they did it, they would have a completely different life when they came through the other side.
Right.
Yeah. Because we're learning. I think our effectiveness is dependent on our learning. And mm-hmm. and if our learning is sort of haphazard and accidental and unexamined, well, we're going to get those kind of results. Whereas if we approach learning with a very clear intention and wide-ranging vision of what we're doing, including post-game analysis, it's just going to change things radically. So let's shift gears a little bit to focus on, let's say you've gone through the process now and you've become accomplished in a field. You've discovered things. You've accumulated a huge knowledge base, and now you want to go out into the world and make some use of that. It might be as an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. advising others, selling advice to others. It might be as a writer or as a speaker or a teacher, or any number of possible ways to do this. How do you make that transition?
Well, there, a key element is a book, as you and I have talked about occasionally,
mm-hmm.
Codifying what you have learned and mastered in a book or publication that is going to be of real interest to other people who want to learn it or to colleagues in the field. Either in the form of a manual, a handbook, a guidebook, an expository book, theoretical book. This can be very helpful, even though it's kind of the old technology. It's still extremely respected and effective in getting speaking engagements, as a credential for your consulting. And as an exercise for yourself in showing yourself and others what you've learned. So I'm a great believer in the fact that, as the old saying goes, everyone has one book in them,
mm-hmm.
at least.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, mm-hmm. most of us who only have one book in us publish 20 or 25. But, but each of us has got one good one.
Yeah.
And so I would even though it might seem presumptuous or pretentious or unexpected, I would encourage people to start thinking about, maybe 3 years from now, what kind of a book would it be awfully nice to have out? And I'm thinking here basically, frankly, of self-publishing as the surest way, as well as frequently the most profitable way to bring a book forth. It's much more respected now. There are very legitimate forms of self-publishing on the web, as I think you know. Mm-hmm. And I would strongly advocate beginning to think in terms of your body of knowledge and learning and expertise as the possible taking off point for some kind of publication that establishes you as a bona fide expert in the field.
Well, earlier when we were talking about the fact that all the big advances in human knowledge, or not all of them, but a huge proportion of them, came from people outside of the organization of that discipline. You talked about people like Freud and Darwin and Einstein. Well, every one of those individuals is associated with one or more books.
Right.
And with the only way we know that there was a Freud, really, or there was a Darwin or any of these people that had such huge impacts on intellectual life, the only way we know that is because they had books.
Mm-hmm.
If these fellows didn't write a book, they might have been very bright in their living room or their den, but nobody would ever know. And so, yes, a physical book is not the most modern of devices. You know, it probably is several thousand years old, and yet it's still absolutely one of the most impactful. And as I always tell people, you know, yes, you can publish electronically, and you should, and e-books are wonderful, and audio files and all these things are fantastic, but I would much rather be on somebody's kitchen table or on their office desk, or in the train with them on their way to work,
right?
Or even in the CD player of their car, than I would be in the hard drive of their computer.
Mm-hmm.
The hard drive of their computer,
right.
I'm very easily forgotten, easily lost, and maybe even very easily deleted.
Right.
Whereas, you know, for instance, just a simple practical matter, nobody throws out books, really.
That's right.
They just don't do it.
That's right,
you know,
Ted.
We were taught never to, you know, do anything bad to a book, and so
right.
You know,
I would invite everyone listening to us to just picture how good it would feel and what the impact would likely be if you right now had a little book of yours that you could send to the next really big prospective client or customer that you're courting in the process of making your pitch. If you could pop a book in the mail and have that on their desk the next morning by 10 a.m., how that might add to your strength in making a pitch. Or if you wanted to propose that you speak at a conference or convention at which there were lots of possible customers or clients for your business, how it would feel to have a book that you could send to the program, the director of the program for the conference, in sending him your proposal for a presentation. Or indeed, of course, how it would feel to have that on your own coffee table when your friends come over. So it's got a lot of gratification, and I think that the discipline of doing it is one that will really help you find out what you still need to know and where your thinking needs to take you in terms of understanding your field.
Oh, exactly. And of course, we didn't say this yet, but the one of the best ways to learn a subject is to start teaching it. Because that's when you really find out, gee, I don't know how to answer that question. Or, gee, I never thought of that before.
right.
Yeah, it's a great thing, and of course the internet has made all this 10,000 times more accessible. You can join forums, which I think are, you know, good ones are worth their weight in gold.
Mm-hmm.
And by helping other people, sharing answers to questions, and sometimes having your answers to questions challenged, this is all a very good thing for promoting specific knowledge, which is what we're after.
Right, and let's keep in mind the kind of small bits kind of book package that is so familiar nowadays, where you can compose a book. You don't have to think in terms of a vast architecture for a book the way people used to. You can think of a book as a set of one page statements on each one on a really interesting theme or challenge or problem or opportunity or aspect or facet of your field, where you can very easily envisage knocking off, say, a single page in the time you have, the downtime you've got in the next day or two, and then revising it over the next day or two. And if you just produce one page every couple of days, by the end of the year, you'll have a respectable little book of important thoughts of yours and ideas of yours or suggestions that are worth putting together between covers. So it doesn't have to be some vast scheme like Darwin's Origin of the Species. Can 75 top tips for internet marketing, or Ron's 130 most important ways to learn, and so I encourage people thinking about a book in that form, because a lot of the most successful books these days are small little books of these kinds of tidbits. As long as each tidbit is really juicy, you don't have to have a vast architecture.
I just recently bought a book, and I hope I don't mangle the title. I think it's On Being Lucky, and it's by a guy named Bo. Oh, this is terrible. I don't have the book handy, but it's a hardcover book.
Right.
I think I paid $15 for it. I believe the entire – I don't think it had even 70 pages in it.
Uh-huh.
And yet it was well-presented physically, good physical presentation, and the content was superb. I mean, it was just excellent, and I felt I got an incredible value. Your suggestion of putting essays or emails or even forum postings together in a book is a really great idea. I was just talking with a very well-known copywriter, advertising copywriter named Clayton Makepeace,
mm-hmm.
and he puts out a brilliant newsletter via email. And every 6 months, he takes all the emails and he puts them into book form, and he sells the book for $79.
Mm-hmm.
And people in that field snap it up because they usually miss one or two of the emails or
yeah.
they lose them. And to be able to have it in a book form is fantastic. I've recently taken some of the better emails that I've written over the years, sort of advice to beginning entrepreneurs, and put them into a book. It was very easy to do, and we're going to actually have a call on that for my System Club members a little later. We'll talk about the mechanics of it, but it is literally easier today to publish a book than it used to be to have to go down to Kinko's and run 10 copies and put them in a binder. I mean, and the reason I say it's easier is you can do it from the comfort of your own home. We found a company, and there's many that you can look into, that will publish a single book for you, just one copy, that is perfect. I mean, it's exactly how it would look if you ran 1,000 or
right.
10,000 copies, and they'll do one for you for $7, four color cover. I mean, this is a miracle.
Yep.
Especially for you really appreciate this because your experience is certainly when you started was the traditional, the book proposal and the,
sure.
the many years of
right.
Back and forth and the editorial
yep.
and waiting for the book to finally come out.
Right.
And now, literally, if you've got material and your point about accumulating it over time in painless bits and pieces is well taken, if you've got the material, you can have a book just as easily as going down to the Kinko's and hitting a copy.
Right.
So it's funny. So here we are in the 21st century, and we're talking about a device that's several thousand years old, and it's still the tried and true. Hey, Ron, I have a feeling that we could easily talk for another day or two about these subjects and not scratch the surface. I want to bring people up to date on some of the stuff that you're currently involved in. One very exciting thing is that the Independent Scholar's Handbook is going to be republished online for free later this year by a university. I don't remember which one.
Right, it's the University of British Columbia at Vancouver.
Great.
Is going to put it up on the web. It's gone through several editions with different publishers, and so my feeling was that I've gotten my compensation for it. Now I wanted to make it a little gift to everybody who might find it serviceable.
I think it's fantastic, and we maybe not immediately, but we have the domain name iScholarsHandbook.com, and at some point when that book is ready, we will have a web page up that will direct you to where you can go to download that book. It'll be cool. And
I appreciate that so much, Ken. Thank you for doing that
for
us.
I can't tell you how thrilled I am to complete this circle. That book, I'm not sure where I'd be today if that book hadn't taken me by the hand and said, hey, look, you can be accomplished in any field you choose even if you don't have the formal credentials, and here's how you do it step by step, and here's all the people in history that have done it, and you should do it too. So that book has a very important message. I know, and we unfortunately we couldn't touch on this, but for years now you have been teaching people with something called the Socrates Way, and your book on that subject has just been published in China, which is very exciting. And so if people want to find out more about that, go to SocratesWay.com. And, of course, Socrates was the great Greek philosopher who taught Plato and just really influenced basically what it means to be a Western thinker. And, of course, people could find out more about you at RonaldGross.com. And there's much to find out about. Believe me, we've barely scratched the surface. You've got a new book called Peak Thinking. It's at the press, or is it out in the stores yet?
No, it's at the press.
Okay, but that will be out in the near future.
One can keep if people are interested, they can keep informed about that through RonaldGross.com.
Great,
thanks, Ken.
Yeah, well, it's for years I've wanted to do this interview, and finally the stars lined up correctly. You know how difficult it's been to for both of us to work this time out where it clicked, but finally it has, and I'm so glad that we got some of this down for people. And I want to encourage everybody that if you found the things that we've talked about on this call interesting, and you want to pursue them in greater depth, you'll find no better guide to the subject of lifelong learning than Ronald Gross. In fact, he's the man that coined the term. And Ron, thanks so much for being on this call. This is great. I'm so delighted to be sharing this with people.
Thank you, Ken. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.